Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. If science and innovation hold the keys to tomorrow's kingdoms, then their successful discovery, nurturing, and commercialization will give advantage to the nations where they are found and built and offer the potential for significant investment opportunities. As the question is posed, are we entering the new industrial revolution? It seemed an ideal time to welcome the CEO of one of the UK's specialised, publicly listed investors in early and late stage science and innovation. Greg Smith, CEO of the IP Group, welcome today for a Money Maze podcast curated episode.
Very good to see you.
Well, I have immersed myself in your specialist topic, it's a bit like a mastermind question, and read that the great scientist is not the one who gives the right answers, but who asks the right questions. Well, as anybody who knows me will know, I am not a scientist, but let's see in this conversation if we can understand your mission, IP's business and its opportunities, UK innovation in terms of where it sits and how world-class is it, sourcing opportunities, where and why you're most excited, some live company examples, the hurdles in the UK to commercializing and retaining more of the great innovations here, IP itself, the vehicle, the discount to net asset value, the risk reward here, and how you see the opportunity for the IP Group to unlock the potential to help turn British innovation into more growth. Short agenda, Greg.
Indeed.
Just give us a quick glimpse of what came before the IP Group for you.
I would say I've definitely been a closet scientist, sometimes sort of in, sometimes out of the closet from a scientific point of view. I read mathematics at university, got sort of, I wouldn't say captured by the thrill of accounting, but after university came down to London and trained as an accountant in the financial services bit at KPMG. Covered a lot of diversified both insurance and asset management and investment vehicles. After a period of time there, I left and went to join a fund of hedge funds in the West End of London. Real insight into different vehicles, different alt vehicles, ways that you can make money, and found that a fascinating journey. At the same time as I was growing with that business, we grew that business when I was there from about $750 million under management to about $3 billion. I was helping to build out all of the operational side of the business. And at the same time, an ex-colleague of mine was busily growing another business through its early stages, and that business was what became IP Group. And I became a mix of fascinated and sort of almost in love with this concept of being able to bring together science, innovation, and the opportunity to make outsized financial returns in one place. And so I left the fund of hedge funds. At the time, I was told you'd be crazy to leave hedge fund world, that's where you make all the money. But I was led by the ability to have purpose and have impact, as well as be able to create a financial return. And so I joined IP Group about 17 years ago now and grew with that business. I was CFO from 2011 through to 2021. We did a lot. We had some international expansion, a couple of acquisitions. We've got a couple of regulated entities. And so the business that I took over as chief exec of in 2021 offered this sort of really interesting opportunity to bring together science and technology and bring together capital and hopefully create outsized returns for investors. And you're always learning. You make loads of mistakes. That's sort of, you've got to be very humble about that and recognize the role that sort of failure plays. But hopefully I've now got the business after a couple of years in the CEO really well positioned for the job at hand. And I think the job at hand is to take the UK from being almost like the world science lab, which we're fantastic at, to being a place where we can grow, nurture, keep many businesses at scale that solve global problems and serve global markets.
I'm going to come back to that because somebody once referred to the UK being one of the world's great petri dishes for such ventures, but a failure to capitalize them on sufficiently. Now, the IP Group is listed, and I wonder if you could just give us the Topco view of your businesses, because whilst you're a listed company, you have three pools, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're probably best known, and I don't know if this has made its way through to the markets yet, we're probably best known for the fact that we are a listed balance sheet. So we have about £1 billion worth of investments predominantly into private businesses, all with an IP theme around them. So most of those businesses have originated off the back of years of government-funded research into science and technology of the future. But over the last few years, I've been diversifying out the pools of capital to make them more stage relevant. And so in addition to the £1 billion we have in the listed vehicle, we also manage about £500 million in tax-advantaged EIS capital in the UK. We have that under a brand, Parkwalk, probably one of the best growth brands in the UK as measured by, you know, sort of awards won and repeat customers and returns. And then over the last sort of 5 years or so, we've also been building out what you'd call sort of venture growth. So in venture parlance, Series B plus, Series C. So quite a lot of the technical risk is out and a lot of it is moved to commercial, back in commercial risk. And we manage about £200-250 million currently in that space. Most of that money is for Australian pension funds. So we have a great partner in the form of Host Plus, one of the top 10 superannuation funds in Australia. And I think there's a real opportunity to expand out that scale up side of things, because that's where there's a real gap in the UK at the moment. And with gap, read also opportunity for us to make some really compelling financial returns and to grow some very, very compelling businesses here.
So we're going to come to several of those, but why would an Australian entity come to you?
I mean, I suppose you'll have read in the press, or if you've looked at anything around the sort of the capital markets industry task force and what they're trying to do to reinvigorate the UK listed markets and what's trying to happen with the Mansion House Accord, which is things around how do we appropriately encourage some long-term capital to have some more allocation to risk assets, to productive assets. And one of the cited stats, which always is quite newsworthy and catching, is the fact that a year or two ago, teachers in Ontario had a greater allocation, just teachers in Ontario had a greater allocation of investment to UK growth and technology in just one company than the entire of the rest of the UK long-term pools of capital did. I think it was raised as a, you know, up the flagpole because it was a partly an embarrassment factor and partly it was a look, you know, here's the opportunity. There are some very well-regarded investors. I suppose that's a long-winded way of saying the superannuation funds in Australia, partly because of the rules that they have over there around the level of mandatory commitments that people have to make, but also partly around the fact that if pension funds don't perform in Australia, they are mandated to come together and become greater scale and hopefully therefore return better returns for their investors. And that has led to an ability for them to make greater allocations into productive assets, so infrastructure, PE, VC, property, and our relative allocations in the UK are lower. And so I think in Australia, the superannuation funds were typically allocating, because there's not much domestic venture market in Australia, so they were typically allocating capital to US VC, to some European VC, and there was a desire to create a local ecosystem. Our success in the UK at helping to create this ecosystem around commercializing science from universities obviously caught their attention. And so we partnered with the group of eight most research intensive universities in Australia. And at the same time, we entered into a relationship with Host Plus to provide private capital. But the intent was they wanted to invest at the appropriate stage, which was sort of Series B plus. And there weren't any companies in Australia really that were originated from universities. So they started to invest with us in some of our UK-based companies, some of our US-based companies, and we showed them a good track record. And that has enabled them to help create the ecosystem in Australia. We've got a portfolio of 10, 15 companies, some of which they've now invested in direct. I'll tell you about some of them in the future, lots of sort of energy transition and ways to get critical minerals out of the ground in a more efficient way. So there's some, you know, some fantastic businesses. But I think they came to us because we had that experience of having created an ecosystem here. And there was a desire to do that in Australia. And we've been able to show them good financial returns.
Got it. So you identify, you invest, you nurture science and technology businesses. And so one of the questions as I was thinking about this, and we've had Pete Davis from Lansdowne on the show, and we've talked about this wealth of IP in the UK. From where you sit, where and how world-class is it?
Well, Pete has been a big supporter of IP Group. You could definitely say IP Group wouldn't have been around without Pete's support. over the last sort of 20 years. So we share many similar views on the opportunity for the UK to really outperform in this area of investing. And Pete's been a big advocate of that. In terms of where the UK is differentiated, I mean, fundamental science and technology in many times comes from universities. And we are very lucky in the UK that we have four of the top 10 universities globally in terms of IP output. In fact, the UK has about 10 to 12% of all of the IP that matters, the sort of the leading IP. And we're second and third only to the likes of the US. So the US has about 40%. So there's a very rich heritage. And I think one of the enduring competitive advantages, or one of the enduring places where we compete internationally, is on that sort of intellectual property. And it's not a partisan, Brits are brilliant at science and no one else is. Those world-leading institutions attract the best minds to come and ply their trade in the UK, and they bring their families and they bring their research teams. And I think the enduring brands of the likes of Oxford and Cambridge and Imperial and many other universities in the UK is a real competitive advantage. So there are areas within that space where we are particularly strong. And I would say the tech sector in the UK is globally interesting. You know, we're the third country in the world to get to a tech sector worth more than $1 trillion, behind only the US and China. So we're obviously doing something right. But the sort of fundamental research, I mean, that stat's probably quite well known. Less well known is how strong we are in the clean tech space, in the energy transition space. The UK is one of the few areas that's continued to have heavy investment into better ways of extracting and transporting electrons, better ways of extracting critical minerals, better ways of extracting things like hydrogen. And a lot of that comes from the research side of things. So there's a number of areas where the UK is very strong from a research point of view. And the trick, of course, is to try and work out which of those can be commercialized and which of those can be commercialized at scale.
Right, which of course leads me to my next question, which is the investment process, which is a lot of universities producing some extraordinary stuff. How do you go about the screening, selecting, narrowing, checking, investing?
In partnership is probably how I'd best describe it. IP Group has been built on long-term partnerships throughout our history, long-term partnerships with investors, long-term partnerships with co-investors, and long-term partnerships in different forms with sources of great innovation and technology. The current structure in the UK, you can think of it a bit like we are the GP, we're the general partner for the university alumni funds of Oxford, of Cambridge, of Imperial, and of a few other universities around the country. We'll add a couple, and that's all done through our Parkwalk brand. And as I said, I think IP Group is probably best known as a balance sheet investor, but over the last year or two, a very deliberate change in strategy has been to move the vast majority of our early stage sourcing. So that's sort of what would be called pre-seed and seed investment. So that's relatively small amounts of money, a few hundred thousand pounds up to a few million. All of that is now done for our universities through the EIS capital that we manage for our clients at Parkwalk. We have about 7,000 clients. They benefit from some very good UK tax reliefs. And we benefit from, therefore, a very wide pipeline. But we manage those alumni funds in partnership with Cambridge, with Oxford. And so we're doing 40 to 50 new spin-out type investments each year. And shareholders and IP Group don't invest those early checks, but they benefit from those that come through the process, and then they become investment candidates. So in the very early stages, a lot of the work is around, you know, is the technology differentiated and viable? What do we think about the team? But I think importantly, really, really importantly, is how can we very quickly validate the commercial opportunity? And it's not as simple as just sort of calling up a customer and saying, do you want to buy a portable DNA sequencer? Because they're like, I guess so. If it existed, of course, I'd be interested. Or would you be interested in a way to extract lithium from a brine field that doesn't require excess water? So there's a very high-level version, but it's about having the skill to be able to talk to potential customers about, well, what would it take? What would the product need to look like? If this was available now, how would you buy it? How much would you buy? And so a lot of the work that we do is around sort of not just understanding the science. We've got a number of PhD-trained individuals in the business that can talk that language and understand the science, but it's also about the commercial application of that science and trying to get a handle on, you know, that sort of the holy grail of venture, which is product market fit. How do you find product market fit, particularly when there isn't necessarily a market to go after? So that's a lot of it is around the sort of the commercial DD.
And you made an interesting point, and I'd observed it in your materials, is that under your stewardship as CEO, you've moved that, it should be considered the sweet spot, away from predominantly venture to more later stage growth. Just explain a little bit about why you thought that was important and what it does to the portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my sort of observation, having been doing this for 17 years, is I think we thought that a single permanent vehicle could do the whole journey from pre-seed to pre-IPO. And then largely you would exit at the point of IPO, or, you know, well, IPOs have been a rare beast sort of in the last few years, but, you know, hopefully that will return. But so to sort of mature exit. And our learning is, particularly in the UK, doing the very, very early stuff is so difficult that the UK government gives individuals 30% tax relief to encourage people to invest in that space, and also gives you loss relief if the companies don't work and is free of capital gains tax. So it's a really well-structured scheme, this EIS scheme. And I was doing, you know, we obviously speak to various parties in Treasury and in the government, and there was some risk that it, you know, that might not be continued. We in the EIS Industry Association did a lot of work to explain the massive impact that EIS investing has in the UK. Something like just under half of all unicorns in the UK have had EIS investment along their journey. So it's really, really valuable as a source of IP. But with that in mind, it makes a lot of sense for our shareholders to have that bit of the investment journey done with stage appropriate capital. And then as those entities, I mean, lots fail. That's by definition, by design. If lots of things didn't fail, there wouldn't be a need for tax reliefs. So I think the idea is you can build a very broad pipeline off balance sheet. Shareholders benefit from fees. They benefit from performance fees if we do a good job. And our investors, our high net worth investors who invest through that platform, also get a good return and a good tax adjusted return.
So you look a lot at life sciences and technologies. Tell me a little bit about how you think about that sort of, if you like, portfolio allocation, because lots more demands on your capital than there is the ability to allocate.
That is absolutely true. It is always thus. There's always more opportunity than capital. So we're a deep tech investor. If you look up, you know, if you ask Perplexity or somebody, you know, give us the definition of deep tech, it will explain that it's things that are transformative businesses, and often they are based around things that improve healthcare outcomes, things that improve energy efficiency or cleaner energy, things that are related to the huge explosion in machine learning and AI. So that's everything from novel computing chips to different types of memory to how you interface with a machine. If you think at the moment, we're gradually moving away. I've got a stylus here. We're gradually moving away from the keyboard and the mouse. And, you know, you'll know the story, the keyboard, all the keys are in a certain order because that was a mechanical device. And it, you know, having the keys that were regularly pressed in the middle to have a lower amount of mechanical effort was the right thing to do. It's not really very relevant for the digital age. So that, you know, there's lots of opportunities to have a different approach. So we focus on really those three main areas: technologies that contribute to a healthier future, technologies that contribute to a tech-enriched future, and companies that contribute to a more sustainable or a regenerative future.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your portfolio companies. I think I'm right in saying you've already backed three companies that have reached billion-dollar valuations. One of them, I think it's maybe a 10% position of your NAV in your listed vehicle, is Nanopore. Disclosure, I am a shareholder in Nanopore. It's obviously reached great fame during COVID time because of its distributed sequencing technology. I'm not being examined here, so I don't have to explain that. Tell me a little bit about Nanopore's, you know, the excitement that has been associated with Nanopore and the fact that for the moment, it appears to have stalled.
Yeah, Nanopore is a fascinating story. I mean, the forerunner, one of the reasons that we were interested in, we were the seed investor in Nanopore back in 2005. We hired Gordon, the CEO, and he was sort of captivated by the opportunity. He'd been doing blood glucose monitoring at Medisense and then Abbott. And I mean, the story goes, it's slightly pre-me, but the story goes, we sort of pitched Gordon an idea on a completely different company. And it's, you know, he had about 45 minutes of a meeting. And then Spike, who's now the commercial director at Nanopore, I guess he sort of read the room and could tell Gordon maybe wasn't that excited. And he said, well, actually, we've also got this sort of single molecule detection system thing. And Gordon was like, oh, that's quite interesting. Tell me more. And he's like, well, you know, we're sort of thinking about using it to detect anthrax on the tube. And Gordon, not sure that's the right approach for it. But long story short, the idea of being able to sequence DNA, the source code of human life, with not just a desktop device, but a palm top device, and eventually in time, perhaps plugged into your phone, was a truly transformative way of doing things. And to this day, we remain convinced, and I think the level of scientific publications that the company's been able to deliver would support this, that this is a fundamentally different technology, different way of sequencing and reading the source code of life. And you're like, oh, that's interesting, but you know, how interesting, how big and interesting is it? Well, the forerunner, the sort of UK forerunner to Nanopore, was a business called Celexa. Celexa was a Cambridge spin out, and back in 2008, I think it was 2006, the business was bought by a small company at the time called Illumina, and Illumina spotted an opportunity in the markets, and they paid about $650 million for this company that was in the UK and was doing about, you know, 100 million of revenue or something. And at the time, the CEO, Jay Flatley, said, this will be the most transformative life science deal of the century. And the UK press said, crikey, this American company's paid $600 million for this company. Good job, we've made a great return. And then, of course, Jay went on to build that business to be worth $50 billion plus. And a number of the team from that Celexa story came to Nanopore. And Nanopore have got a broader application of technology. And Illumina's done a brilliant job of cornering and growing the so-called research markets. But if you look at the history of those research markets, notes on Illumina from 5-10 years ago were saying, actually, the so-called applied markets, so that's in things like clinical and in biopharma, those are an order of magnitude bigger, maybe a $50 billion type opportunity. And there was always the promise that the technology of Illumina would make that leap across to the applied markets. But for some reason, it's never quite happened. And one of our hypotheses is that's because the form factor of the devices, it doesn't suit the applied markets. If you want to be able to, as an example, sequence a tumor, a brain tumor, live during surgery to give the surgeon a steer on whether or not it needs to be removed, whether you've got all of the tumor, what type of tumor it is, and therefore if you can change your treatment plan, you can't do that with kit, which you need to take a sample, send it off to a centralized lab and get it back. Whereas with Nanopore, that's an actual example of what they do with the technology, which is incredible from a human impact point of view. But you can see it sort of unlocks these applied markets. And so whether or not the company has got there as quickly as it could have done is a debate that could be had. But the fundamental scale of opportunity that Nanopore faces is, I think, still unchallengeable. It's really, really interesting. The public markets have been difficult for Oxford Nanopore. I mean, let's bear in mind, they floated at the absolute top of the cycle, and all of the life science tools companies were on, you know, 20 to 30 times multiples. The long-term average multiples was about sort of 10, 11 times, and many companies in that space are now trading at 2 to 4 times. So there's been a long way down with the markets. This year, the business is, I suppose I would pick out three things that Nanopore's done well. The first, it's delivering revenue growth well ahead of its peers, you know, 20% plus, whereas most of its peers are doing sort of either single digit or indeed contracting. And importantly, now 30% of Nanopore's business is in these so-called applied markets, and they are growing quickly, and they're a lot less influenced by the research budgets. So things like the NIH in the US, which has obviously seen some sort of public questions about how they're going to deliver their budget, whether the budget's going to be renewed, etc. So they're quite insulated from that. So there's good growth opportunity there. The second is they've added a number of these sort of strategic partnerships during the course of it. They're already partnered with people like the Mayo Clinic, but also UK Biobank, and being able to do some of those really sort of fundamental population scale things. But then thirdly, and I think from a financial point of view, really interestingly, they have these strategic partnerships with the likes of Apple, NVIDIA, but importantly this year, Novo Holdings, who of course have been a guest on the show, they took a nearly 5-10% position, and their representative joined the board. citing the opportunity for Nanopore to completely disrupt and be aligned with some of their strategic goals. So that's quite a good validator. And then secondly, the Ellison Institute of Technology, which is located very proximally to Nanopore's offices. They are now the largest shareholder. They've just surpassed us. And so I think it's very interesting. You've got these sort of strategic shareholders who have taken a long-term view on the equity, which acts as some form of validation for the long-term opportunity in Nanopore.
Thank you. That's clear. And I know you're very excited about it. And as I looked at the portfolio and talked to people who were well-placed, they brought up names like Hystata and Istesso.
Yes.
I got that right now. Nick Feingold, who you know, who we know as well, has been the guest, runs the curation court, said about Istesso. He said, you know, for rheumatoid arthritis, what's happening could be a monster.
Yes.
True or false?
No, definitely true. I mean, I assume he means monster in a good way as opposed to yes. monstrous.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, so within the healthier future bit of the portfolio, we have a number of therapeutic companies, so drug discovery companies, and we therefore have a reasonably diversified pool of companies that are transitioning through various clinical stages. Istesso is one of those businesses, and it really is a truly differentiated approach to dealing with these very endemic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, where in essence, the body's immune system gets overactive and attacks the body's own cells. In the case of RA, that is your bone, and it uses a huge amount of energy. It makes sufferers very fatigued, creates a large amount of pain, and the symptoms are very well controlled with traditional drugs. Lots of the biggest selling drugs in the world, some AbbVie drugs and others before the COVID vaccines, biggest selling drugs in the world were for treatments of rheumatoid arthritis, a very big market opportunity to go after. What this drug does, and we had a recent trial readout, which was mixed, I would say, but it really underscored the unique features of this compound. And the bit that's really exciting, and I'm sure the bit that Nick's talking about, is it's the only drug we're aware of in the world which cures the underlying condition leading to symptomatic relief, whereas all the rest of the drugs have symptomatic relief. And so what we saw in the trial, which was particularly interesting for the people on the trial, was a big reduction in fatigue and a big improvement in their quality of life, like basic stuff like being able to get out of bed in the morning pain-free, being able to open jars. And there's a bit more work we need to do from a clinical point of view. But I think if we can, over the next sort of 18, 24 months, if we can help that company to navigate its way through, there's a very big prize, both from a financial point of view. I mean, these compounds, if you can get them through successfully, can be very, very valuable. The upfront and our share of the upfront of such a deal could eclipse our market cap, but it comes with associated risk. But from an impact point of view, you can transform the lives of tens of millions of people. And, you know, a colleague commented, he saw the results presented and he said, look, you know, almost as a layperson, if the drug gave that kind of behavior, I would definitely want to be on that drug. And the good news is the drug is incredibly safe. So we've got a bit more work to do on that one, but it could definitely sort of eclipse the market cap. And then to pick up on your point on Hysata, Hysata is talking about these superannuation fund investments in Australia. There's world-class research going on in Australia as well. I wasn't aware of the University of Wollongong until a few years ago. There's a serial entrepreneurial professor over there, a guy called Jerry Swiger, who is a fantastically humble but excellent prof. And he, as academics do, he was looking at hydrogen electrolyzers, and electrolyzers are about 60 to 70% efficient, which means you waste about 30 to 40% of the energy that you put into them, comes out as heat, has to be cooled, you know, all those sorts of problems. And of course, he, you know, looking at this as a prof, he was like, well, I wonder how you know, what's the main cause of that inefficiency? How can I get rid of it? And long story short, he came up with a new way of putting an electrolyte between the anode and the cathode in an electrolyzer. And broadly, you can sort of pour water in the top and you can get hydrogen and oxygen out of the bottom at about a 95% efficiency, which means 80% less inefficient, which means less cooling, but it completely transforms the economics of creating green hydrogen. So much so, in fact, that the Hydrogen Council had a target that you might be able to get to a levelized cost of hydrogen of about $2 a kilogram by 2040, 2050. We've got line of sight on doing that within a couple of years. So it completely transformed the economics. And that's important because about 10%-ish of the energy needs in the world can't be made green using electrification or other methods. So hydrogen is needed in the energy transition. So there's a very, very big value proposition there in the tens of billions if we can get it through its sort of scale-up phase. So there's lots of sort of those billion-dollar shots on goal.
Yeah, well, look, one of the problems you have to deal with is that investors can be very short-term and they're always looking for inflection points. Over the next 12 to 18 months, what might be some that have a better than average chance of materializing?
Yeah, this is a question we get asked sort of every year by all the brokers and the sales teams and shareholders. And I mean, in a way, it's actually quite good to keep the business honest because a lot of private investing is done in 10-year fund structures. And your LPs will ask you for a 6-month report, a 12-month report, but it's quite a long-term time frame. So one of the differences doing this in the public markets is you need to think each quarter and each half year about the milestones you're going to achieve. When I took over as chief exec, I took the view that I might as well lean into that. And so try in every results presentation to set out here are some of the companies that could hit their milestones. I will warn you that they're not all going to, but these are the candidates and you can hold us to account for whether we hit them or not. So for this year, we've talked about in the last year, we've had a couple of really good successes in our deep tech portfolio. So we had a fantastic Cambridge spin out called Featurespace. We were the first institutional investor in that business. We were the biggest shareholder at the point of exit. That was actually our fourth company, which was, if you take the exchange rate on the day, it's almost exactly $1 billion exit. So that was our fourth. And we sold that business to Visa. We generated a sort of 6x type return, very healthy IRR. It's very good. But it's meant that the sort of 2024 was the year of deep tech success. I think 25 and into 26, we've got some really good shots on goal in the healthier future bit. So we've got a number of companies that are reading out clinical trials. And if they are successful, good line of sight on commercial outcomes for those businesses. So I'll pick on a business called Pulmicide. And Pulmicide is treating a condition for people who have either a lowered immune system or have had a lung transplant. And it's a naturally occurring mold that, you know, is in the soil and is in fertilizers and things. If you've got a suppressed immune system or a weakened immune system, it can get into your lungs and it can take root. It's not very nice. And you can literally suffocate to death. It's horrible, you know, and standard of care, maybe 20, 30% efficient. In a breakthrough trial in about 10, 11 patients who had failed all the standard of care, I think we saw 9 people survive out of, I think, 10 or 11. So completely remarkable. And so that company is now doing what's called a phase 3, so large population. And that phase 3 will read out the early part of 26. So hopefully this time next year, we'll have had a positive outcome from that. And I think there's very good pharma interest because this is a very hard to treat area. And so that could be quite a compelling financial return. And then from the tech stroke clean tech portfolio, a business I'm personally really excited about is Oxa. Oxa is software for autonomous vehicles, and it could be used in passenger transport, robo-taxis, etc. But our view is, and the view of the company is, that's going to take a long time to come to fruition because there's lots of regulatory hurdles. On-road driving is a different animal to off-road, but there is a huge 40 billion plus opportunity in off-road applications. So that's I'll sort of pollute your mind slightly because I now can't do this without. So if you travel a lot, you go on planes, when you're sitting on the runway waiting to dock, have a look out the window and you'll find there's somebody waiting with the fuel truck and they're sat in the cockpit. There's somebody waiting with a cargo truck and they're sat in the cockpit. And there's somebody waiting with the trolley that's going to come and replenish the food trolley, etc.
Gate catering.
Gate, indeed. Gate catering, very good, yeah. And each of those people has to sit and wait for their turn in the process. Now, imagine how much more efficient it would be if those people could be doing something more productive and weren't sitting waiting. So if you could automate those very repetitive tasks, which is what you do with robot process automation, then how much more efficient could an airport be? How much more efficient could a port be? How much more efficient would it be if in a mine, you didn't have to have a driver in a cockpit, very well protected? Then you can completely transform the way that you move things. And so Oxa has got a deployable software solution that can work in any vehicle, in any environment, with any sensor technology. So it's completely agnostic. And we're just at the point of working with a number of the big OEMs, ranging from little vehicles that remind me a little bit of Wally that go around and they inspect solar farms. And they, you know, so they've got great big solar farms in Australia, 5 miles by 3 miles. And one of the challenges is you get these hot spots and you get fires, and it's, but you can just get this little vehicle autonomously driving around. It knows where it's going and takes temperature readings, and it can act as an early warning. So if we can get those early customers to scale, the opportunity is huge. And there are some very valuable public comps. There's a business called Aurora in the US, which is valued, I think, at about sort of $10, $12 billion. We hold our holding in Oxa. Our share of our holding in Oxa gives a company value of about $500 million. Neither company's got material revenues yet. So if we can crack that sort of ARR over the next couple of years, there's an incredibly valuable, potentially multiple of our market cap type opportunity. So there's lots to be excited about, but I think there's some good examples.
So lots of interesting companies, different stages with potentially very large returns, some of which won't work because that's the nature of the investing. And behind all of this is a UK problem, which you are part of the solution, but can't carry the world on your own shoulders, which is this risk aversion in the UK. You mentioned earlier on about tax advantage EIS. I think there's that stat that more people have crypto accounts than share accounts, but we have tax breaks on ISAs. For cash ISAs, it's absolutely absurd because that's the one thing you don't want. You want people to be investing for the long term. Give us a sense of what is happening in the UK, and looking backwards is typically less helpful. What might be changing to improve risk appetite?
Well, it's a cultural thing in the UK is a big part. I often think about our sort of US peers and compatriots, just things like the simple stuff. If you fail running a business or a business fails, the kind of adage is, here, that's a kind of crikey, you know, don't go near that person again sort of thing. Whereas in the States, they're like, well, you know, brilliant. You must have learned so much from your failure. Now you know what to do differently next time. Get on and go. And, you know, I'm sure guests on your podcast I've heard have used in the past that old adage about you learn the most from the things that you fail at rather than things that you succeed at. So I think that's a slight cultural difference. And we need to have appropriate risk warnings on our financial products. Look, you know, I train as an accountant. I'm very well versed in the governance. I'm a director on a couple of FCA authorized entities. So I understand the rationale. But I think the balance has shifted far too far the wrong way. And what people don't necessarily understand is that what is badged as the lowest risk opportunity often can be actually on a sort of inflation adjusted basis can be the highest risk if you invest in something which gives you a fixed return lower than inflation. In real terms, that's incredibly risky because you know your money's going to be worth less in 10 years' time for sure without the opportunity for the upside. So all of this is to be taken within a balance of a risk framework for sure. I think there's been good work done in the last few years. I mentioned the Capital Markets Industry Task Force at the London Stock Exchange, and I've been an advisor with the London Stock Exchange for the last 10 years, including working on this new crossover private market, PICES, which I think is another interesting thing we can do in the UK to help liquidity in private markets. But I think from our bit of the world, what can be done? I'd pick on sort of three areas, I suppose. One is we need to supercharge our spin-outs. So we punch at least in line with our weight, if not above our weight, in new company creation. EIS has been very good for that. But I think we need to make sure that those companies can access the capital that they need to scale. And so things like the Mansion House Compact are a very good way of ensuring that an appropriate spotlight is put on those companies as a component of the productive asset question. And that leads me on to bridging this scale-up gap, which is sort of the second area. Ways that we can think about bridging the scale-up gap include nudges, positive nudges, rather than negative nudges. So there's some interesting things in the UK, like if you were to invest in a company like Tesla, which is a non-UK business, you wouldn't suffer stamp duty on your transaction. If you were to invest in a company like Jaguar Land Rover as a UK-based business, you would. And that seems almost the wrong way around. At least it should be a level playing field. What they've done in Australia is you get tax credits as an investor for investing in domestic stocks. It's not a huge amount of money, but obviously trustees and the managers of these pools of capital have got a fiscal objective as their primary objective. So there needs to be some rationale for ensuring that you've got justification for investing. It's got to be a return-led investment. That sort of scale-up gap is most acute at the sort of series C, D, E, where if you look at the data, we've done some work with PitchBook, actually the quantum, the total capital raised by companies once you get beyond series C, D, E, declines in total, which is unusual and either suggests that companies are moving ashore or they're being acquired. And that pool of capital is exactly the stage where our relationship with Host Plus is targeted. And so I think there's a lot that we can do in the UK with UK pension funds to be able to offer a service with a, you know, sort of a long track record and a diversified portfolio that would allow them to allocate capital in a sort of measured way. And I think the third area is helping to sort of solidify the success of those companies. So you get the, you know, get the spin outs, help to scale them up. And part of solidifying the success is in the areas where we have domestic benefit. So for example, in the NHS, we've got a big challenge in the NHS from a productivity point of view, from healthy aging, from a diagnostic and preventative point of view. I mentioned earlier, Nanopore is a, they've entered into a number of partnerships with UK institutions. There's a really great symbiotic relationship that could be had where novel technologies that have reached a certain stage of commercialization can be safely tested within bits of the NHS. If that successfully is shown to work, then it can be rolled out across the NHS. Fantastic. But it can also then be credibly rolled out globally. And that means you get almost like a kite mark from technologies that have been developed, and that benefits the UK from an investment returns point of view, benefits the UK from an improvement in productivity in the NHS, and it opens up a global opportunity for those businesses in global markets. So I think there's those sort of three aspects to what we can do.
Looking at your stock market capitalization, is it around £380 million?
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the frustrations, and we've had lots of conversations with other entities listed on the exchange and exchanges, but, you know, is the discount to the net asset value? You probably can't talk exactly, but it is said that maybe it's a 40%+ discount to net asset value. How do you think that is addressed? Is it simply time and good execution?
So I'll couch this in a little bit of history. So we came to market in 2003, and at times we've traded at a big premium to NAV per share, and at times we've traded at a big discount to NAV per share. And at the moment, we're in a time of big discount. I mean, we're probably about a 50-60% discount at the moment, actually. And if you were to strip out cash and our holding in Oxford Nanopore, it goes to more like 80% discount. So yes, long-term returns, delivering returns on our NAV per share is clearly the sort of the, you know, the kind of long-term KPI. Cash on cash returns obviously being the most important. Things that we've done in the shorter term to address that, and this is as a shareholder with the benefit of trying to create a benefit for long-term shareholders, is because we've had success in realizing assets for cash profitably over the last year particularly, we are allocating more of our capital to buying and retiring our stock at those discounts. And if we're right, and obviously we're putting our money where our mouth is by buying back stock, if we're right on that, then we will be reducing the denominator and amplifying the returns that we make on our portfolio for the benefit of shareholders. So this year, actually, we're using about 50% of the realizations that we make to buy back our own stock and retire it. That isn't the long-term game, isn't to continue to buy back and make the business smaller, but it's a really compelling short-term opportunity. And you have to balance the opportunity to invest in the portfolio with the opportunity to retire stock at, you know, what look like very compelling prices to us. So hopefully that will turn, and hopefully a return to risk appetite and, you know, sort of UK small mid-cap exposure. I think we're long overdue a, you know, sort of reversal in the UK outflows. But, you know, running a business, you can't wait for that to happen. You've got to take active steps. And part of that is returns, and part of that is hopefully smart allocation of our capital.
And if you were to give yourself a pat on the back in 5 years' time, what would be the criteria that would allow you that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You should envision success and aim towards it and hold that success in your mind. I think for IP Group, we were known as a single vehicle that was listed and invested in private companies. And it was exciting, and it was private companies. I think the business has evolved under my leadership to be one which is now more of a diversified manager. And I say diversified in the context of we still do VC and we're still deep tech, but we've now got a vehicle which has got $500 million of sort of almost like sourcing capital, $1 billion of mid-stage VC, and a few hundred million of later stage. I don't think there are any other vehicles in the UK which offer UK-wide exposure with a bit of international flavor to companies that are right in the crosshairs of what is trying to be done with improving UK productivity, UK growth, i.e., you know, science and technology, scalable businesses that need capital. And I think that vehicle, if I can look back in 5 years' time and say this was the point at which we grew our scale-up capital, we delivered great returns for our investors, we gave birth to and nurtured and exited not just four companies worth $1 billion, but 5, 10, which is more than possible from the pedigree of companies that we have both in the UK broadly and in our portfolio. So I would look back at having created significant financial impact, but also significant real world impact. We'd have helped to create a true cure for rheumatoid arthritis. We would have helped to make real the ability for somebody to create hydrogen and use it to abate steel making. And we would have enabled the digital revolution, the digital transition through faster, cheaper, more energy efficient chips. I mean, that would be, you know, that's not a bad thing to achieve in 5 years.
Yeah, and democratizing access to these private initiatives. Surega, that's been a really informative conversation. You know, IP Group's listed on the London Stock Exchange. You've described very well your mission. You are overseeing a pool of long-term capital that is addressing and trying to commercialize UK productive assets. I guess that if I was looking at it, and as I said earlier on, I'm a shareholder in one of the companies that you've been party to for a long time, is that you are allowing people to access earlier and later stage development. It's a public company vehicle. You're a co-investor in a number of these adventures, and you do have a competitive advantage in the knowledge economy. And if we're to believe anything about the future, or in such an unknowable world, have any strong sense that it is that the knowledge economy and so much of this new industrial revolution is going to embrace a lot of the stuff that you're working on. So I think it's a really important conversation. The fact that you have the vehicle for those that want to participate in that, and hopefully the pension fund universe is going to increasingly recognize more money should be going into risk assets and more retail money should be going into such assets rather than crypto accounts, can be a good thing. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Very good to talk.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.